Welcome to the Baltimore Museum of Industry. We're so happy to have you here this evening.
I'm Matt Bush, presenting a special WYPR Talks to the Big Dig. WYPR's Juan Boy Kamau and Congressman Johnny Olszewski spoke with Ian Koss about what's next for the Key Bridge. This conversation was recorded at the Baltimore Museum of Industry March 31st.
Hey, folks. Thank you so much for coming out. I remember exactly 2 years ago, probably many of you remember it as well, waking up to see this video that was almost unbelievable to see. An interstate highway, a bridge made of concrete and steel that had been standing there for decades, just crumble like it was nothing and fall into the water. It was just arresting to see. And I will say, as somebody living far away in Boston, that was the end of the story. As far as I was concerned, that was it. But I know that here in Baltimore, that story has continued to go on and continued to play out. And that is why I wanted to have this conversation here tonight about what happens next after an iconic, essential piece of infrastructure like this is in a night wiped off the map. How do we rebuild? How do we respond to that quickly and also with an eye towards the future? So joining me for that conversation, we have Juan Boy Kamau, who is a reporter with WYPR, who has been covering the aftermath of the bridge collapse. We also have with us Congressman Johnny Olszewski, representing Maryland's 2nd District and formerly the county executive for Baltimore County, including at the time of the bridge collapse, as well as Arkea Wade, who is a board member of the Turner Station Conservation Teams, as well as a leader of the Turner Station Girl Scout Troop 353. Did I get that right? And she's also a resident of Dundalk, which folks like me have to look up on a map, but you all know is an area located right at the end of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Arkea, I want to start with you. Take me back to that night in March of 2024. When did you realize something had happened?
Well, it woke me up out of my sleep. I woke up and it was like a loud boom, and I just automatically assumed it was like a transformer or something that happened or whatever. And then probably like
the kind of boom that you feel.
Yes.
Not just here.
It shook the house. It literally, I live on Dundalk Avenue, maybe a mile or so from the bridge. I mean, I'm close. I mean, obviously, because I heard it. It woke me up.
Wow.
I mean, it was like, you know, the house shook. But things happen, you know, transformers, things, you know, I hear stuff at night. And so, but this one, you know, woke me up out of my sleep. And probably like, not even like 45 minutes after that happened, my niece came in my room and said, "Auntie Arkea, the bridge collapsed." And I was like, "What are you talking?" I mean, it was like 3:30 in the morning. And I'm like, "No, the bridge didn't collapse. What are you talking about?
Go back
about?
To sleep."
Yeah, right. And she, you know, showed me the picture. And I mean, it was crazy. So at the time, my dad was living in Hampton, Virginia, and he is from Baltimore. He grew up in Turner Station. So we called him in the middle of the night and told him, and he was like, "What are you talking about?" I mean, it was just eerie. It really was.
Congressman, how did you hear?
So I was serving as Baltimore County executive, but I was running for the seat that I now have in the United States Congress. And I was actually supposed to be in Annapolis the morning of the collapse and was staying there to receive an endorsement from the Teachers Association. So I was awoken by multiple calls from my fire chief, Joanne Rund. And at first I picked up and she said, "Boss, you're not going to believe this." And cargo, she actually said it was a cruise liner. A ship carrying passengers originally was the report that it crashed into the Key Bridge, total collapse. And I think I was in such a daze from just waking up and feeling disoriented, I was like, "Oh, okay, chief." I laid back down and then I opened my eyes and I said, "That has to be a dream." So I called my fire chief back. I said, did you just call me to say that there was a ship that crashed into the bridge and it collapsed? Yes, sir. And he was like, oh, crap. So I did not yet see any of the footage, hadn't been released. And so I was calling my chief of staff, my communications team, was calling the mayor of Baltimore, the other county executives in the region to try to get verification that this had happened and to tell my my team I need to get back to the scene. And it was maybe an hour or so later we were on scene, and in fact the Francis Scott Key Bridge had been struck and it did collapse.
So everybody tells me that you're called Johnny O.
That's
Can
right.
I call you Johnny?
Please.
Arkea and Johnny. There's something just very Baltimore about that. I don't know, Johnny O, but we're going to roll. I love it. Could you give me a sense of the significance of this bridge? Why it matters, not just as a, like, it carries this many cars a day, but for the people who are from that place, like you both?
Well, I don't think that any one person can do it justice, because that bridge meant so much to so many people. So much so that it's the kind of thing that sports teams would wear on their uniforms. It was such a part of who we were. It was our identity.
Like the silhouette. Mm-hmm. You just know it.
You just know. And all of Baltimore kind of embraced it. We're Eastern Baltimore County folks, so we have a certain swagger about the bridge being ours, but we recognize that this is something shared by the entire Baltimore.
It's everyone's bridge, but it's really our bridge. Okay. I understand.
And if I could just add to that, for someone from the west side of Baltimore, people know where to go in the west side of the city to be able to see the bridge.
It's like a landmark,
right,
that you navigate by.
Right.
It's an architectural wonder. It was a beautiful bridge, but it was also a place where, you know, at least for me, it was a rite of passage that people, my generation, when we got our driver's licenses, we would cross the bridge. It was one of the things we did. I grew up on the water. I fished under and around the bridge. It's what we did. We put it on our uniforms. And some of that, for me at least, is tied to the fact that it's such a part of the American story. Right? It's the Francis Scott Key Bridge, named after the author of the Declaration, the Star Spangled Banner. And so I think there is so much pride, not just in what the bridge means locally, but that bridge helps tell a national story that is so important.
When after the bridge collapsed, I reached out to some older adults in the community, and just to check on them, because, you know, there's so many, Turner Station's like the closest community to the bridge. And, you know, you have residents that have lived there for years and years and years, and people who knew when the bridge was built. Like, you know, my father remembers when the bridge was being built. And so it's such a staple. And, you know, I had reached out to them like, you know, how are you feeling? And, you know, they were like, this is weird, you know, that the bridge is, you know, it's like quiet. They were used to the noise of the bridge. And I remember one particular person told me, like, That same night, I think he had called, I guess, down to the bridge because there was a lot of noise. And, you know, they said that they couldn't stop the noise or whatever during construction. And then, like, a couple hours later, the bridge, you know, collapsed. So,
Wamboi, can you speak to now the transportation side of it? Because the bridge is a pretty symbol, but it also serves a purpose. You've been reporting on, you know, the aftermath, how it affected the port and how it affected the city. What did it mean to lose that road?
Yeah, I think that was one of the first things I would hear when I would go out in the community and speak to people, was that it wasn't just a bridge. It, like Arkea just spoke about, people had memories of their uncles, their fathers helping to build it. So there was something kind of legacy about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, it was a connection link, because in that part of town, you're surrounded by water and you can easily go from like Herman's Bakery shop in Dundalk and cross over to Glen Burnie, or even maybe more like important places to go, like the airport.
Mm-hmm.
So I think losing the bridge really has become something that where people have lost connection.
Yeah.
And not just for commercial districts like shopping or, you know, going to and from the airport, but something else that I've heard on both sides, the Dundalk side and the Anne Arundel side, is also just a sense of community, because a lot of people socialize through churches.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard pastors saying that the pews are emptier.
Wow.
Because people are now are unwilling to, you know, drive for possibly 45 minutes or more. So even it's even, I would say, a family strain.
Yeah.
Where if somebody lived on one side of the bridge and they came over, instead of every Sunday having dinner, now you're seeing them maybe once a month, if that.
Mm. So 45 minutes for what used to be 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
I would say 15 or 20.
20 minutes.
Yeah.
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 For me personally, my Girl Scout troop, we lost a volunteer because of the Key Bridge collapse. We had an older lady who lives in Glen Burnie, and she would come do these sewing projects with my Girl Scouts. And when the bridge collapsed, she said, I can't come to the troop anymore because I don't like to take the tunnel. So for me, you know, my Girl Scout lost our older adult volunteer. And I mean, I visit her, but not as much as I, you know, wish I could. And, you know, she literally hasn't been back in 2 years to the troop because of that. So
it's a reminder of how much infrastructure can actually define what we think of as, you know, proximate. Just that it actually changes how we see the geography of the place.
We will have more with The Big Dig on the Key Bridge after the break. I'm Matt Bush. This is WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
Live from Baltimore, you are listening to WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station, where support comes from listeners like you and from the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Conductor Hannu Lintu leads music by Sibelius, including Night Ride and Sunrise and Symphony No. 7. And pianist Francesco Piemontesi performs Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4, May 14th and 17th at the Meyerhof. Ticket information at bsomusic.org.
Check out the latest episode of Your Child's Brain, a podcast series produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WIPR. I'm Dr. Brad Schlager, president and CEO of Kennedy Krieger Institute. Join me and my guest, Dr. Brenda Banwell, as we discuss exciting advances and current challenges in the field of pediatric neurology. That's Your Child's Brain, available on the first Thursday of every month at WYPR.org, kennedykrieger.org/YCB, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And the instructor said, your parachute should open. If it does not, punch, and your safety parachute should open. If that does not open, you will plunge to your death in 11 seconds.
Join us for more true stories told live. Next time, Circus Acts, Loving Boldly, and Leaps of Faith. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
You can listen to the Moth Radio Hour every Saturday at 2 in the afternoon here on WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
I'm Matt Bush, presenting a special WYPR Talks to the Big Dig. WYPR's Wamboy Kamau and Congressman Johnny Olszewski spoke with Ian Koss of Boston's GBH podcast, The Big Dig, about what's next for the Key Bridge. This conversation was recorded at the Baltimore Museum of Industry March 31st.
When I came to the story, you know, so my background is in, I did this project about the Big Dig in Boston, which is all about trying to remove a highway from the city. And so one of the questions I had coming in was, well, I don't know, do we really need to rebuild this bridge at all? You know, can't we just use another bridge? And everyone I talked to was like, oh, no, we're definitely going to rebuild the bridge.
Yes.
Because there's so much tied up in it. But the other thing I would hear about a lot is trucking. That this is a really vital link for the industrial functioning of the city. Is that something you could speak to?
For sure. So 35,000 passenger cars went over the Key Bridge every single day. That's just passenger cars. Thousands and thousands of trucks use the Key Bridge as their primary means to travel up and down the corridor along 95. Because both the Harbor and Fort McHenry tunnels, which are now being primarily used as the alternative to the bridge, are not allowed to have hazmats, these trucks can no longer use that eastern route, so they're all diverted now to the west side of the Beltway and have to go all the way around the west of Baltimore up and around to be able to traverse their goods. that's real impact for the companies here. They're still paying the increased fuel, especially as fuel costs are now significantly rising. That's real time. They're able to do fewer loads. And the traffic, of course, has gotten significantly worse. And we see that both as commuters, but also from a business perspective. We did a great job, you know, clearing the port of the channel when the bridge collapsed to make sure that we saved the port of Baltimore. But the port and other related shipping industries are still very much being affected. And so I think having the bridge being rebuilt is really an economic imperative, not just for the Baltimore area, but it's a core shipping corridor for the entire country.
I think that is a good transition to bring up. We have two more guests with us today to really look at that forward-facing piece of what do we do now. So I want to welcome up Deputy Secretary of Transportation, Samantha Biddle, as well as Klaus Philipsen, who is the president of ArcPlan, Inc., an architecture and urban design firm in Baltimore, and a longtime transportation advocate in the region who has worked on too many projects to mention. So, Secretary Biddle, Deputy Secretary Biddle, Samantha?
Samantha's good.
Okay. We're on a first name basis here. One of the marvels of this story is that 11 weeks after the bridge collapse, the shipping channel reopened. The wreckage was cleared away. Could you take me to that day and just the mood in the Department of Transportation, in your team, as you were looking ahead?
Absolutely. I think that the mood was exhilaration, maybe a little bit of fatigue, because those 11 weeks were intense. The ability to mobilize the crews that were involved to move over 50,000 tons of material out of that shipping channel, it took thousands of individual effort. People mobilized from agencies, state, federal, local. But the ability to see those ships coming in and out of the port is where we knew that there was a bright future ahead for the port. But we also knew that the work was just beginning on what needed to come after that. Governor Moore set four objectives early on in terms of the response to this tragedy: making the families whole, supporting our communities, supporting our industries, reopening the channel. So we did that after 11 weeks, what a lot of people said would take 11 months. But we knew that the rebuild was really where a lot of the work was going to come for years.
And did you already have a sense that the rebuild was going to be a lot more difficult than clearing the wreckage?
Certainly. I mean, I've been in the transportation industry for about 20 years now. I'm a planner by trade. And while planners can think creatively, we sometimes like to mull over things just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
But this was a challenge in terms of a structure that wasn't necessarily on our plate for rehabilitation or replacement in the near term. So taking something where we didn't have plans ready to go and figuring out where we were going to head first, that was definitely a challenge. We knew that that sort of endeavor has taken other agencies on average easily 7 to 10 years to get to the point of really starting that work.
Yeah, one thing that struck me in just kind of revisiting the timeline of the story is I was reminded that there was that bridge collapse in Philadelphia on I-95 just the year before. There was like an oil tanker that caught fire and this bridge collapsed. And I feel like it got a lot of attention nationally. And I think the governor of Pennsylvania got a lot of political hay out of it for like within a matter of days getting the bridge functioning again. And it was sort of this rallying cry of, oh, yeah, like when it's a crisis, we can really come together and we can put all the complexity aside. We can do it. But this is not that.
Marine construction's a little bit different. We want to give our partners to the north all of the credit for the work that they did quickly. But, you know, there's not a really great analog for the work that we have ahead of us and even for the accomplishments that we've made, you know, in the past 2 years.
Yeah. So, Klaus, you're observing this from outside government as the conversation around this new bridge starts to take shape. What's your response? What are you seeing and how are you reacting?
Well, first, the congressman said a moment ago that this is an architectural wonder. And as an architect, I like to hear that because it is a structure. It's not just a highway. So a structure that you compare with a horizontal skyscraper, and you still have the height when you are on it. So it is vertical and horizontal. And it was a structural wonder at the time when it was built. It was one of the largest continuous truss bridges in the world. And it has a presence in our memory partly because of that. And when it collapsed, it was traumatic also for professionals that design structures, similar to when the World Trade Center came down, that it is possible that something that you admired as a wonderful structure and an ingenious structure, when certainly you thought it was a stable structure, that it could just fail like this. That in itself is traumatic. And, you know, my experience with that, I was walking in the morning at 6 o'clock. I do this on my morning walk, and the neighbor drives to work, and he usually comes by and just waves, and he stopped and he reached the phone out of his window and showed me the video. And I was like so struck that that's possible, that yeah, this bridge can fold like that.
But as an architect and a designer, once you saw this process moving forward, what did you want to see in how do you think about replacing an iconic structure like that?
Right. So iconic structure, it's a landmark. It's something special. It carries in our collective regional memory. And so the new bridge has to do this again somehow. And, you know, the exhibit back there shows it was also built in Baltimore. It was built in Bethlehem steel. The people that built it were local, and they used locally made steel for it. And I was very impressed by the cleanup effort, because the cleanup effort happened in a very unusual way. There was this unified command, and Johnny O and other people, the governor and the mayor, and they were all almost every day in front of the public and explained, here's the timeline, here's what we have been doing today, this is what we're going to do tomorrow. Here you see the pieces of equipment rolling in. It was super transparent, and it was very impressive that they actually got it done within the timeline. And so my first thought was that the reconstruction should be done in the same way. That, well, you laugh. I mean, the idea was that all the silos, all the people that sit in their various silos, that they would not stay there, but that they would all collaborate from the federal to the local level, and the departments would sort of disappear, and the procurement process would be disappearing. And then I started looking at where else did they build something real fast. And then it came up with Genoa in Italy, which, you know, is a bridge that is on land, but it has about the same length. And it fell down in an comparably dramatic event that cost 45 lives in that case. And they built it back in 18 months. So, and it was designed by an architect. They have in Genoa, the famous Renzo Piano, he came in and said, well, I help you guys design the bridge. And, you know, they did a lot of modular construction so that the pieces would repeat and that they could do it faster. They never went out for bid. They immediately started with design, and then as soon as they could, construction. And some of this MDOT is doing too. But I'm looking for now is that the community, the professional community, as well as the local community, would be on eye level partners in designing this thing. And that is what I was hoping for, and I'm still hoping for. But so far, we had one communication, and that was about it.
We will have more with The Big Dig on the Key Bridge after the break. I'm Matt Bush. This is WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
As spring returns to the land of pleasant living, our thoughts leap to summer evenings and Maryland's largest free outdoor concert series, WTMD's First Thursdays. From June through September, we bring the best local and national acts to Baltimore's Canton Waterfront Park, mixed with local artists and vendors, a wide array of tasty food, and a bunch of friends you just haven't met yet. WTMD's First Thursday concert series kicks off June 4th. Admission is free. More details at WTMD.org.
Wine experts are called sommeliers, and in the world of coffee, they're called Q-graders. And only recently have they begun to grade a key ingredient of chocolate, cacao.
A lot of the cacao producers live under poverty limits, and so there are a lot of economical challenges.
How a cacao grading system helps farmers and consumers on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered Monday through Friday, beginning at 4 in the afternoon here on WIPR, where support comes from J-More, Baltimore Jewish Living, presenting Mark My Word, the podcast that goes beyond the headlines and looks into the issues that affect Jewish Baltimore, with host Mark Terrell. Available where you stream your podcast and at jmoreliving.com. WIPR is also a proud partner with the nonprofit news site, The Baltimore Banner. Together, WIPR and The Banner are bringing local news you can trust to Maryland. Learn more at thebanner.com.
I'm Matt Bush, presenting a special WYPR Talks to the Big Dig. WYPR's Juan Boy Kamau and Congressman Johnny Olszewski spoke with Ian Koss of Boston's GBH podcast, The Big Dig, about what's next for the Key Bridge. This conversation was recorded at the Baltimore Museum of Industry March 31st.
There's, if you'll indulge me, one story about The Big Dig. There's a piece of that story I've been thinking of that feels relevant here, which is when Boston was planning the Big Dig, you know, this epic infrastructure project. In the run-up to it, the most controversial piece of the whole thing was a bridge, the Charles River crossing. And there was endless debate about how many on-ramps there were going to be and how many lanes and how wide the lanes and how you connect from this route to that. And it nearly killed the project. And then the state, they released a design by this, you know, fancy star architect. And it did all the things that people want in a bridge. You know, it, you know, evoked the local architecture and the history of the city. And it had this elegant cable stayed, you know, layout. And all of a sudden, people stopped talking about how much it was going to cost and how many ramps there were and how many lanes there were. And something that I take from that is that sometimes the aesthetics, and we've talked all in this conversation a lot more actually about symbolism and aesthetics than we have about mechanics. Sometimes the aesthetics can really matter to the politics. And so I'm wondering, Samantha, for you, but also for others too, like how you are thinking about the visual design of this bridge and putting something out that the public can be inspired by.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was a tremendous accomplishment for the project when we did release some of the first aesthetics and the first renderings for the project. It was probably about a year ago. And that allowed people to, you know, visualize for the first time what it was going to look like. What's so different here is that, yes, there's a desire for aesthetics, but there's this desire for reconnection.
My view is also that we are designing a bridge that's going to be good for 50 or 70 or 100 years. We are really entering a different age of transportation with autonomous vehicles, and that we need to accommodate these different futures. And so I proffered from the beginning, we should build a bike pedestrian pass over the bridge. You know, think of the Golden Gate Bridge. This is a very popular thing to be on that bridge. My first step into Maryland was on the Key Bridge. And I didn't know that I would ever move here or any of that. We drove over the Key Bridge and not through the tunnel because I misread the map and thought that wasn't complete because it was a dashed line. And so then we stepped out and said, look, yeah, there's Baltimore and you're my brother and me. So I do have a personal connection to a bridge that was in 1983. We should have a viewing point. This is so fantastic to be on that bridge and look into backwards into Baltimore. Just why we love the bridge so much is also that from so many points in Baltimore City, you could see the Key Bridge. When you went on a sailboat, that was a destination. Oh, let's sail out to the Key Bridge and then back. You know, so
I think a lot of the points Klaus raises about the design and form and feature are good. I'll leave that to the professionals. I am not an architect. I do think it should continue to honor that legacy of, you know, our national anthem, Star Spangled Banner, however we do that. I've been pushing for lights at least, but as I talk to constituents, I'm told you all cleared the channel in 11 weeks and the bridge still isn't taken down 2 years later. Reestablishing that connection between communities and also that commerce is just so critical. And so that's sort of what we'll keep pushing and working with our partners to try to help get done.
And we were able to secure an environmental clearance, for this project in the matter of months. And that was a strategic decision that was made in order to expedite the process by agreeing to an in-kind replacement, the same number of lanes, just with updated design standards.
I could push back a little bit on this. I fully agree. I think it could be faster. I don't know why we lost 2 years in the original timeline, but the categorical exclusion, you know, the bridge is 50, almost 50 feet higher than the old one. It is 20 feet wider than the old one. It is 200 feet or 250 feet offset to the side from the old one. If all of that is possible within the categorical exclusion, I would think that a 10-foot walkway should also not be off the table.
Is this where we call out the federal highway representative that you have waiting in the wings?
Yeah, who's going to mediate here?
We will have more with The Big Dig on the Key Bridge after the break. I'm Matt Bush. This is WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station, where support comes from listeners like you and from Burton's Grill and Bar, now open daily in Bel Air's Tollgate Marketplace, serving contemporary American cuisine with handcrafted cocktails, including the Burton's Old Fashioned. Alfresco dining available, menus available at burtonsgrill.com.
Practical Parenting, the new podcast from GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches to find joy in the process and thrive through it all. The goal? To ensure parents have the resources, support, and confidence they need. Practical Parenting from GBMC. Available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether we're reporting from the front lines of change or shedding light on what it all means, wherever Morning Edition goes, you go too. Bear witness with us every morning from NPR News.
Beginning at 6 a.m. Monday through Friday with your host, Taylor Holbrooks. Support for WYPR comes from the Maryland Department of Health. The Good Samaritan Law protects anyone witnessing or experiencing a drug or alcohol overdose if they call 911, as they cannot be legally arrested or prosecuted for drug use or simple possession. More at stopoverdose.maryland.gov or by phone at 988. This is WYPR at 88.1, Baltimore's NPR news station.
I'm Matt Bush, presenting a special WYPR Talks to the Big Dig. WYPR's Wamboy Kamau and Congressman Johnny Olszewski spoke with Ian Koss of Boston's GBH podcast, The Big Dig, about what's next for the Key Bridge. This conversation was recorded at the Baltimore Museum of Industry March 31st.
But seriously, I mean, these are questions that get settled by the Federal Highway Administration, and you can make your case.
Right. And we had a representative from the Federal Highway Administration who was literally positioned with us at the Unified Command from day one, working with us hand in hand on all things associated with the eligibility of all the work that we were doing to make sure that we could use federal funds, both on the clearance process to clear the channel, as well as looking forward.
And that representative explicitly said, if you include a pedestrian or bike facility, then it will have to go through
explicitly
a separate environmental impact statement. And was that really what closed the door on that for you?
I think there's, you know, I don't want to speak for all of the decision makers in the process, but I think that the potential delay was definitely, you know, a big consideration.
Yeah. Wamboy, I know you've been reporting in communities and talking with advocates around this project. Can you... What are you hearing?
I understand this, the speed that the governor and others want to move forward with. But in addition to what Klaus was saying, I think there are people who were willing to wait because they saw this as a once-in-a-lifetime sort of opportunity. And I'm thinking about Samuel Jordan, who passed away, but he was a transit equity advocate. And one of the things that he was fighting for was for the people who lived in the lower income communities, when we think of Cherry Hill, more on the Baltimore side, because it's not just the port that's the commercial center. These are people who live in neighborhoods where the median income is about $33,000 a year. So for someone making that amount of money, a car is unaffordable. But so they were really hoping that this bridge, if it had pedestrian access, it would be somewhere that they could bike to work or walk if really needed, or even just have public transport. I know Klaus is mentioning like self-driving cars, but even just some form of public transport where they could go from home to work and it would be able to uplift people in those communities.
I mean, it seems like, to me, to try and kind of distill some of the themes, the fundamental question here is, do we focus on rebuilding it as quickly as possible, exactly what we had before, or do we take this as a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-several-lifetimes maybe, opportunity to rethink what that bridge represents?
Well, to which Obama would say you can walk and chew gum at the same time. So this needs to be done concurrently. This is a several-year-long process, and now they're driving pylons where the foundations for the pylons. So there is no reason why you can't at the same time talk about how the bridge deck, how the bridge railing. And I wanted to also, when the equity theme comes up, you know, both sides of the bridge are landing in areas that are disadvantaged areas, disinvested communities from Turner Station on one side to, you know, the Baltimore Highlands area on the other. And these land areas, they will look different in 50 years if we are doing the right thing. So the bridge is also a ferment that could move our land areas and our communities on both sides further along than they are. And a lot of this is marshy land on the west side. So it's a recreational opportunity. And there's Fort Howard that we don't know what it's going to be in the future. There is Trade Point Atlantic, which is going gangbusters, but we don't know exactly, you know, where that's going to take us.
And for folks listening later who are not in Baltimore, Trade Point Atlantic is, it's like an Amazon fulfillment center.
That's the old Best Lamentz.
Okay, wow.
I got to stop you right there.
Okay, give us the quick gloss on Trade Point Atlantic.
Yeah, Bethlehem Steel, which helped build parts of the Big Dig and is an important legacy here, has been replaced by Trade Point Atlantic. It's a multimodal rail, highway, seaport facility that has everything from manufacturing, shipping, logistics. We're now building a multi-billion dollar port, the first private port, I think, in the country's history in some time, perhaps certainly in my lifetime. There are 10,000 jobs already on site, thousands more coming every day. We have a new park that I put there when I was county executive. It is a site that has transformed what was. We cleaned up some environmental damage. So it's a lot more than an Amazon.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
Center,
but
it's 4,000 acres.
Yeah. And I think to Wamboy's point earlier about access, I mean, I spoke with a cycling advocate in preparation for this from a group named Bike More, who was telling me that you see people on e-scooters on the side of 695 trying to get to Trade Point Atlantic because that is the only way they can get to work.
Yeah. And possibly the best person to speak to that would be you, Arkea, because you're in that pain point of having to decide when you'll go to see the doctor because you don't want to go at 3 o'clock when traffic is backed up and there's potholes and whatnot.
Well, the people that I talk to, they want the bridge back up. I mean, you know, I'm not, it's been a inconvenience. People don't, you know, traveling, like I said, to Glen Burnie or Anne Arundel, even Annapolis to the airport, it's a problem. So I do understand. I mean, Klaus has helped me understand like some of the aesthetic things that we could do, or environmental friendly things we could do or recreation things that I never even really thought about. But I think delaying it, if that added on another 2 years, I think you're going to lose some people.
Nobody wants to delay it.
The other big question hanging over all this is the federal funding. Congressman, are you worried that the federal funding for this will get pulled?
Well, I'm glad to hear that on the ground things are going well, because I take the threats from the president of the United States to the governor, to the state, to members of this congressional delegation to pull back funding very seriously. The good news is it is clear and established law, 100% funding that the United States government will reimburse the state for. But this is also why I take the threat so seriously, because I've seen this president take back money that was already approved into law, particularly from Democratic-led states for things like energy projects. There was supposed to be an offshore wind project at Trade Point Atlantic that millions of dollars were canceled, I think illegally, by President Trump. I'm working every day to make sure that I'm telling that story about how important this bridge is, not only to my community, but to this country, so that we solidify that support that cuts across party lines. Because, you know, at the end of the day, if we can't be there for each other, what are we doing? And in your time of, and sort of the pitch is, in your time of crisis, whether it's an earthquake or a fire or a flood or a bridge collapse, the federal government has always been there. And so really just trying to solidify what is already law, because the one thing that is of concern is that laws can be changed. And so I've gotten overwhelming support. I know that our senators, Van Hollen and also Brooks, are doing the same in the Senate. I feel very confident that funding will stay, but it's also why I've pushed so hard against the rescissions and have fought to put language in some of these budget attempts by this administration, because once that contract is broken, it's hard to have any confidence on any of these projects moving forward.
Is that part of the hesitancy around tweaking the design or adding things like pedestrian access? Is any opening like that could be become a crack that you drive a wedge into and that kills the whole thing?
But for me, sure. You know, any opportunity to create a division to second guess why we're funding 100% or 90% of the project is something we should be, I think, very cognizant of. We all should be making sure this project is done on time. The last thing we want is to get to 2030 and say, oh, actually, it's going to be 2032, or to have any further cost escalations. I know the initial estimates were immediately after so that we could secure that 100% funding. But I think we are all very, very well aware that this is a time of, in many places, belt tightening. And so from my perch, anything we can do to make sure that we are giving confidence to my colleagues in Congress, to this administration, that we are building it as quickly as possible and on or under budget, I think that only helps our cause.
We will have more with the Big Dig on the Key Bridge after the break. I'm Matt Bush. This is WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to 88.1, Baltimore's NPR news station, where we have the BBC News Hour coming up at 3 here on WYPR, where support comes from Baltimore Metro Council, celebrating Bike to Work Week Central Maryland, May 11th through the 17th, by encouraging cycling for commuting and recreation. Events include group rides and commuter pit stops leading up to National Bike to Work Day on May 15th. Registration info at biketoworkmd.com.
Practical Parenting, the new podcast from GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches to find joy in the process and thrive through it all. The goal? To ensure parents have the resources, support, and confidence they need. Practical Parenting from GBMC, available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You see the suburban house in flames. You run to rescue anyone left inside, to put out the inferno. Exhausted, you finally collapse back inside the truck and return home to your cell inside the prison. On the next Snap Judgment, fire escape. Do not miss it.
You can listen to Snap Judgment every Saturday at noon here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1.
I'm Matt Bush, presenting a special WYPR Talks to the Big Dig. WYPR's Wamboy Kamau and Congressman Johnny Olszewski spoke with Ian Koss of Boston's GBH podcast, The Big Dig, about what's next for the Key Bridge. This conversation was recorded at the Baltimore Museum of Industry March 31st.
Just to give you all a second to think on it, I want to ask you, Samantha, since you are in the hot seat in the Department of Transportation, what can we expect? So to give us the state of the bridge project, what are the next big things we can look forward to? And when do you think we will have a new bridge?
Wow, that's the billion-dollar question if I've ever heard
October
it.
October 30th.
Yeah, well, I'm not sending out the invitations to the ribbon cutting just yet. There's obviously a lot to do, but I think, you know, you had the opportunity to head down to Fort Armistead and take a look at the work that's happening out there in the river. So, you know, we completed the demolition.
Hear them pounding.
Hear the pounding. I think that's an 800 kilojoule hammer that we've got, you know, getting those piles into the river. And it's really exciting because it didn't happen by accident. And that's what we're going to continue working on through this spring, more of these piles out in the river, building some more of the work area so that we can get more equipment in there. But we're in this period of kind of, you know, aggressive mobilization, and we'll be working with our contractor to hone in on, you know, that final cost and schedule.
Notice you did not give a date.
I did not.
Well played.
Just as we were talking about cost, there's so many costs to this. The greatest cost is the six people who lost their lives. And then from the community side, of course, there's the cost that people like Arkea are going through in terms of the air quality, because there are these trucks that are still, they're not supposed to go through the local roads. But sometimes when the truck drivers are in a crunch and they want to deliver what you just ordered off of Amazon, they go to these local roads, and sometimes they tear up the roundabouts or the traffic lights. So there's also that cost, the health cost of these communities that are now breathing, you know, diesel engine trucks that they weren't before. And then there's also kind of like a leisure cost for the people like Johnny. Oh, he grew up fishing there and that type of thing. And for people who can't access the water. So I just wanted to make sure people are also thinking that the cost is not just the $5.2 billion or however much more it may rise, especially now that anything that has to do with oil or shipping is will cost more because of what's going on in Iran. But I think people are just so excited for whenever I talk to people about what do you want to see up, I haven't heard people say, you know, being as specific as Klaus was of whether it'll be the O's colors or the Ravens colors for the lighting. I just hear people say that they want something that's safe, something that's not ugly, and something that Baltimore can once again be proud of.
You know, so putting aside budget questions, let's assume a budget. Between now and the completion, what are the two things we should be watching for that be challenges, whether it be challenges in the timing of construction or something like we saw with the Big Dig, you know, some of the problems faced there. So what two things should we be watching for?
Price of steel, price of labor.
Hi. So I kind of work slightly in the maritime industry. I do, it's hard to say. I make models for virtual maritime simulators. And one of my tasks was to go in and delete the old Scott Key Bridge and then make a new Scott Key Bridge. Which was sad. But I was wondering, because I looked at the rebuild project website for like specifications and stuff, and I noticed that like a lot of the specifications didn't seem final. Do you know like when there will be those like specifics like solidified on like the exact height and length and everything for it?
So we're at a little past 70% design right now. We'll be at final design, you know, later this spring. But some of the design specs you need, we might be able to help you out with kind of where we are right now in the process. But I think you're definitely in the maritime industry.
Okay, cool.
The tallest one of the towers is just over 600 feet.
You know, when we started out, we thought we were going to be at about like 200 original bridge, 185 feet kind of vertical clearance. Originally thought 215, and we ended up at 230. So when, you know, those design specs change, you get a little taller, you get a little wider of a span. And so those are the things that, you know, those design parameters pretty much, you know, set for right now, put into place in a way that reflects the maritime traffic that we're seeing now versus the maritime traffic that we saw when the original bridge was designed and constructed in the 70s.
You're accounted also for a lot of sea level rise, right?
Absolutely.
I want to end with just a final personal question to you, Arkia. Living right by the bridge, when the new bridge is open, because I think it's when, not if, what's the first thing you're going to do? Where are you going to go?
Oh, that's a good question.
Or who are you going to see?
Maybe go see my volunteer.
Yeah.
And Glen Burnie.
Thank you so much for doing this. And thank you all for coming out. I also just want to give one more special thank you to WYPR. Really could not have done this without the support of the station. Thank you to the museum. Incredible space. If you want to hear the recording of this conversation and all the other conversations like it that we're having around the country this spring, the podcast is called The Big Dig. You can find it wherever you listen. And if you want to see where else we're going, the whole listing is at wgbh.org/bigdiglive. So go check that out. Tell your folks to come be part of the conversation. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you for listening to this special broadcast of The Big Dig on the Key Bridge. It was produced by executive producer Amy Walters. We'll be back with the news roundup on May 15th. I'm Matt Bush. Have a great weekend.